Now we're going to bring in Glenn Greenwald. Glenn was a practicing attorney and previously doing constitutional law, civil rights litigation. He began blogging and now blogs at Salon.com. He's the author of two New York Times best-selling books, How Would a Patriot Act? A Critique of the Bush Administration's Use of Executive Power, and A Tragic Legacy, which examines the Bush legacy, if you can call it that. His new book, Great American Hypocrites, Toppling the Big Myths of Republican Politics, just came out, and it examines the manipulative electoral tactics used by the GOP and propagated with the help of the establishment press. Glenn Greenwald.
Good to be here.
Let me ask you first, as I think I had let you know in setting this up, I have access, of course, to, you know, hundreds of blogs, and I find the one that I read most consistently is yours. This is not just to, you know, shine on to you, but that I find what you're talking about covers a wide range of things, but always seems pertinent to the day. How did this happen? You were basically just, you were basically just practicing law. When did you begin this transformation?
Well, my interest had been in defending the Constitution and preserving our constitutional framework, and I always thought that the best way to do that was through litigating on behalf of people whose constitutional rights had been violated. And over the years after 9/11, in 2002 and 2003, I really became alarmed by what I thought was the very unprecedented radicalism of this government and what became quite obviously the abandonment of our basic constitutional principles, spurred on by things like the detention with no process of any kind by U.S. citizen of U.S. citizen Jose Padilla, and the Bush administration's actually arguing that they had the right to imprison even U.S. citizens on U.S. soil with no charges. And so I began becoming more interested in expanding the work that I was doing, and I had been reading a lot of blogs and was impressed by the political discourse that was taking place on them, and so one day spontaneously just decided that I would start my own.
And, I mean, just because I, again, am curious in this evolution, how did you end up on Salon and then becoming an author? I mean, previous to this, had you thought, wow, I've got a book I need to write, but I'm too busy in my law practice?
No, none of that had occurred to me. I began blogging in late October of 2005, which obviously I didn't know at the time, but it turned out was about 5 to 6 weeks before the New York Times revealed to the country that the Bush administration was illegally spying on Americans with no warrants in violation of FISA and the Fourth Amendment. And that sort of was an embodiment of all the issues that had been interesting to me, because the underlying theory, of course, of the administration was that the president has the power to act outside the law in all matters relating to national security. And so I began writing about that issue at a time when very, very few other people, certainly in the media, were writing about it. And I wrote about it on a daily basis virtually and started getting a lot of attention from other blogs and eventually even mainstream media outlets, and I think what that reflects is that there's just such a lack of any kind of critical journalism that takes place in this country, so that if you dedicate yourself to doing real journalism, which really just means critically evaluating what our political class says and investigating it and exposing it, you can fulfill an important niche that isn't being fulfilled, and I think that's what happened, and that's why I was able to get a lot of attention for the work that I was doing.
And then how Would a Patriot Act, your first book, I can see is the one that comes the most out of your constitutional issues, civil liberties issues, and so on.
Right, and that book was published in May of 2006, which was about 5 months after I just started my own blog one day, and I had been approached by a group of people who wanted to publish a book on the executive power abuses taking place in this country, and they asked if I'd be interested in writing that book. They had been reading my blog and were aware of the work I was doing, and I said I would, and we wrote it very, very quickly in about 6 weeks, and because nobody else literally was talking about those theories of executive power and those abuses back then, it immediately became a bestseller. There was obviously a demand for that mm-hmm. kind of a discussion, and yet nobody was really doing it.
Right. The thing about the executive power grab we saw in FISA, in the violation sort of that and so on, it turns out that that was just one piece of it, right? In other words, the signing statements was another. The Alito, I would say the Alito and Roberts judicial philosophies are another part of it. Could you speak about that? I framed it with Josh Silver, who preceded you on the show. We talked about the media. I said, how is it broken? How can we fix it? I have a feeling with you what I'd like to talk about, if I were going to use that same frame of how is it broken and how do we fix it, it would be the sort of the checks and balances of American democracy.
Well, that's right, and you make a good point, and I alluded to it a little bit ago, which is that when it was revealed that the president was violating the law, was committing felonies, in how he was eavesdropping on American citizens without the warrants required by law, it wasn't just the significance of that story wasn't merely that he was breaking the law and committing felonies. That's obviously significant. But the broader significance is that the reason that he believed he was able to do that, and it wasn't as though when he got caught he said, oh, I'm sorry for what I did, or he denied it. He came right out and he said, proudly, yes, I have been doing this, and I'm going to continue to do this. And the reason for that is because he became convinced by ideologues in the Justice Department and in Dick Cheney's office that, in essence, the president really does have the power of a king, particularly in times of threats to national security, by which I mean that the president literally is unrestrained, unrestricted in his power to take actions as long as there's any remote touchstone to defending the country, which means he can violate laws that prohibit torture, he can detain U.S. citizens without any due process, despite what the Constitution says, he can eavesdrop on us without warrants, no matter how many laws we pass saying that that's criminal to do. It was really a complete destruction of the core premise of the founding of the country, which is that there is no such thing as unchecked power in American government. The way that you avoid tyranny is by ensuring that all branches can check one another and balance one another and limit each other's power. And the president's theory, or the theory of the Bush administration, was really a complete and fundamental departure from everything that this country was founded to be. That's how radical, extreme, and dangerous it really was and is and continues to be.
Right. And you pointed out torture, neglect of habeas corpus, the eavesdropping and so on. If we could say the first thing is, okay, we have an administration that was looking for an opportunity, I believe, to take what they call this unitary executive, this royal power. I thought that right after 9/11, when instead of talking about an incident, he talked about a war on terror, I remember at that moment going, uh-oh. Especially if people remember at this point that although his approval ratings now are half that, his approval ratings on September 10th were about 47%, which for a new president were remarkably low. And it was when he transformed himself from being an unpopular president to being commander in chief. That's where I think a lot of this began. You agree?
Oh, absolutely. And if you know, there's a kind of misconception that all of this sort of began on September 11th or afterwards. And one of the prices that we pay for having such a slothful and broken media. Is that facts that are so important that are right there in the open don't end up getting reported. If you look at things that Dick Cheney has been saying for the last, 30 years, and when he was in Congress, he dissented from a report on the Iran-Contra scandal that the Congress had essentially concluded that the Reagan administration broke the law by sending aid to the Contras, even though Congress had passed laws prohibiting that. And Dick Cheney dissented and said that Congress has no right to restrict the president's foreign policy, and the president had the right to send aid to the Contras, even though the law prohibited it. He's an ideologue who has yearned for this model of the presidency that really depicts the president as monarch.
Right. He also... You just became a little weaker. your sound did. Do you know if anything changed on your end?
No, hopefully that's okay.
Okay, you're back. I was also going to say when he and Dix Rumsfeld were assistants to President Ford, they fought as hard as they could to keep from honoring the Freedom of Information Act, which, you know, it's, I mean, as you say, if you followed Dick Cheney at all, this is merely the fulfillment of his dreams.
Right, and you look at, you know, and you look at the people that they appointed, you know, to run their Middle Eastern policy out of the White House, and Elliot Abrams, and people like Paul Wolfowitz and Doug Feifel at the Pentagon, who were advocating openly that the United States go and invade Iraq and overthrow Saddam Hussein and occupy that country for years before September 11th. But none of this was discussed or reported or disclosed or known. In the 2000 election. I mean, it was about, you know, Al Gore inventing the internet, and
right.
Did he inspire Love Story, and do you want to have a beer with George Bush? And so all of these abuses that were right there in the open and easy to see had anyone looked were basically suppressed by our establishment press when the election occurred, and so none of that was taken into account.
Right. Now, you mentioned the thing about Al Gore inventing the internet. I think one of the things that people may forget also, and it was the thing that actually radicalized, if you can call it that, Paul Krugman, was that the Bush campaign lied repeatedly. Certainly what attracted Paul Krugman's attention was how they lied in terms of their numbers, what the tax cuts would do, what the economy would be like, and so on. And the media did nothing with those substantive deceptions and instead focused their attention on Gore as a flip-flopper and the things, as you said, like Love Story and Invented the Internet, an incredibly bankrupt performance. Let me ask one question that has occurred to me on this whole idea that they hang their unitary executive on is his role as commander-in-chief. So if you declare we're under threat, if you declare a war on terror, when in fact, you know, that's a helpful frame for them, one which I don't think is a useful one. Then they say, well, because he's commander-in-chief in certain matters, which to them seem to be most, he isn't beholden to the Congress. Even that is false, that the commander-in-chief only gives him rights in very limited arenas, correct?
Yeah, I mean, all you have to do is look at what the founders said when they were forming the country and what they intended the Constitution to mean. Their principal fear, and this is just common sense, was that there would be a part of the government that would consolidate the kind of power that they had just waged an extraordinarily risky and bloody and costly war in order to free themselves from. I mean, their principal preoccupation in forming the U.S. government was how do we prevent the consolidation of power? And obviously, the position that was most like the king of England would be the president, the single figure who would be the executive. And so they were very careful about emphasizing the limitations on the powers that the Constitution vested in him. And no less a personage than Antonin Scalia wrote a Supreme Court opinion in 2004 where he actually said that the Supreme Court wasn't going far enough in limiting Bush's powers. And what he said was that the commander-in-chief was intended to be nothing other than the top general, basically the person who, when there's a war, that's the only time that there's a commander-in-chief in this country, when there's a war, when Congress declares a war, you need somebody at the top who decides troop movements and how we're going to fight the war, how we're going to prosecute the war, and the strategies that we're going to use. And since we are a country that lives under civilian, not military rule, that person is the president who acts as the commander-in-chief. That's all it is the person who is in charge of the military and the prosecution of a war. It is not some, you know, trump card or some enormously broad delegation of powers for the president to act like a monarch. And how we arrest American citizens or spies on our conversations or interrogates us or breaks the law. All of that is so far removed from anything that the founders would have envisioned that it's hard to express in words. It's a complete perversion of our form of government.
How have they gotten away with it? Because that goes more to the root of what's broken in this society.
Well, that's a complicated question, but there are several, you know, factors that I would point to. The first one of which is the failures of the other institutions that are designed to prevent this kind of abuse of power. I mean, what the founders counted on was that there would be numerous checks on the other branches, one of which was supposed to be the Congress. And yet the Congress, of course, while they were controlled by the Democrats initially in 2001 and 2002, and then the Republicans through 2006, and now again the Democrats, have done virtually nothing to limit the president's abuses, and in fact have done the opposite.
Right. Let me just point out to listeners what you've just said, is that of the 7-plus years that we've had so far of the Bush administration, the Republicans were only the dominant role in Congress, although it's always been, laser-thin edge. They've only been the majority for a little over half of that time.
Yeah, they controlled the House the whole time until 2006, but the Senate in 2001 and 2002 was controlled by the Democrats, and now again in 2006, 7, and 8. So you're absolutely right. The responsibility
What's your sense? Split. What's your sense, Glenn, of why they have been so passive in the face of, as you say, this is not minor things. This is not a one-off action. This is a consistent pattern, and it's a consistent pattern which isn't about little things. It's about torture. It's about war.
Yeah, it's about allowing the president basically to subvert and degrade our system of government. Look, I mean, just because someone has a Democrat, a D after their name, and is a Democrat, doesn't mean that they're principled, passionate believers in liberty and democracy. So a lot of them went along with it because they believed in it. Others of them went along with it because they're craven. They were afraid to stand up to the president because they would be called unpatriotic and weak on terrorism, and thought that it was in their political interest to go along with it. Others of them are just plain indifferent. You know, they don't really care. They're there for their own self-aggrandizement, and so they aren't particularly interested in. And that's why at the end of the day, the responsibility lies with the people of the country. And you see now that the country has turned so predominantly against Bush and against the Republicans that the Democrats have become mildly more defiant. So, you know, I think that that's really the ultimately always the answer is politicians in Washington will do what the people want them to do.
Okay, so if we take that, we've talked about how it's obvious the checks and balances have been destroyed, ignored, and so on, and a little bit, and I will just say in one sentence, the other most complicit group was, of course, the media, as you referred to in some of the earlier discussions. So you put craven and self-interested legislators and then a craven and profit-oriented media, and you end up with these abuses not being fought. If I give you 2.5 minutes, what can citizens and listeners do?
Well, citizens always have the ability to change the government in small and large ways. And you just look at American history and the profound changes that have happened, and that's conclusive proof of that. So, you know, as people start to agitate and demand for fundamental change, eventually that will happen. Now, one of the big problems, as you suggested, is that there's been a huge corporate media, standing between the government and the citizens that have basically blocked information from getting through. But there's alternatives now that have been developed on the internet, radio shows like this one, and the more information that people avail themselves of, the more they're able to join together and form together in movements in order to change things. And that means seeking those things out online, seeking them out in alternative media, and ultimately devoting themselves and their resources to ways to change the government. If people want that enough, that will happen. And if they don't want it enough, then it won't.
And you see signs? You see positive signs?
I see positive signs in how this president is, you know, one of the most unpopular presidents in modern American history, and there's fundamental dissatisfaction with the government that's pervasive, according to every poll, in the American citizenry. Now, those are good things. I mean, before you can have change, you need people to realize that the way things are now, the political class and the power institutions are corrupted. And I think people are starting to realize that in a deep and fundamental way. And then the second step is to funnel that into change that's constructive and real, and that's the more difficult part. But I think the fact that the first step is happening and has happened is definitely encouraging.
Okay, let me, lastly, if I give you 45 seconds, if people turn to your blog at Salon.com or they pick up your book, Great American Hypocrites, what's in it for them?
Well, I think that the perspective that I bring and that people who have been blogging bring is one that is outside of the Beltway power structure and outside of the establishment media. And so it's really this, everything that I write is really an effort to dig deeper than the standard media narrative and to critically evaluate the information that we're being fed. And through just looking at the objective facts and documenting how our government has been corrupted, to just really illustrate the reality of what's going on in this country and why these radical degradations of our political culture have been permitted to occur.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Glenn Greenwald.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And keep up the good work.